are listening to WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord, streaming live at WNHNFM.org. This is State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're here from the American Friends Service Committee. And during these COVID-19 times, we are recording online to bring you our weekly State House Watch radio show. We continue to put out our weekly State House Watch newsletter. While the legislature is not actively doing their regular business right now, our attention is on the actions by the New Hampshire state government to respond to this crisis, both in terms of protecting public health, but also helping us to weather the storm financially. So there's still a lot going on that we need to stay on top of.
And in fact, Maggie, in the latest State House calendar put out by Speaker Steve Shirtliff, the Speaker of the House, he does note that they're starting to make use of modern technology and figuring out how it can become possible for legislators to meet in official sessions while still satisfying the requirements of our right to know law, which says that any legislative business needs to be conducted in public. So we're not seeing that exactly yet, but the Joint Fiscal Committee has been meeting in public. There's another meeting that is scheduled of another legislative committee, and I think that we'll start to see that at least initially. These will be committee meetings continuing to take executive action on bills that they have already held public hearings on, trying to get to what would have been the end of March crossover period for all House bills to be dealt with and sent over to the Senate if they pass. So we're going to keep an eye on that. If you're not yet getting State House Watch by email, go to our website at afsc.org/NH and hit the subscribe button, and you'll see us in your inbox on Friday.
And so just a quick comment or question about the executive session. So obviously the public will be able to listen in on those executive sessions. They are not typically an opportunity for public testimony. That only happens very informally in the room if a member of a committee invites a comment from perhaps an expert in the audience, et cetera. But I am curious if the House is going to take up action on Senate-approved bills, they'll need some sort of mechanism for actual public hearings where they can hear testimony. So we expect to see an expansion of some of these online opportunities to enable forward movement beyond the executive session.
And it's interesting, Maggie, because there was also some discussion already going on this year about how to use technology to make it possible for people to observe or participate remotely. I mean, if you think about people who live up in Coos County, it's a very long drive to get down to Concord to try to attend a public hearing. If it were possible for people to participate remotely, it would really open up access to the whole legislative process for people statewide in ways that can only be positive. So in some ways, as Representative Weber commented on her Facebook page the other day, this is a silver lining in a sense in this whole process.
That's right. We are building new muscles and learning new capacities that should serve us well for transparency and inclusion down the line.
One of the other ways in which greater inclusion has been advocated has been to make it easier for people to register to vote and to vote. And it's interesting, Maggie, that just last week, Secretary of State William Gardner amended his own previous comments about the impact of the pandemic on voting by saying, well, previously there was a guidance from the Secretary of State and the Attorney General that said, in effect, that because health officials are telling us that it's unsafe to go out in public, then in effect, we are all disabled and can't avail ourselves of absentee ballots if it's unsafe to go to our polling places to vote. Well, last week, just in an interview, not in any kind of official document, the Secretary of State said, oh, well, of course, actually, if you're disabled because of this epidemic, you can also register to vote by mail. Now, that is a ruling that I think is welcomed, but it's not something that is backed up exactly by the force of law, or at least not clearly. So I think I'm hoping that that will continue to get clarified, and we certainly need for people to know about it and perhaps get to a point where even if there's not a pandemic, it becomes easier for people to register to vote and to cast their ballots on election day.
That's right. I mean, we certainly applaud the expansion of access to voting and to registration during times when showing up at a voting booth would put people's health and even lives at risk. But for an administration and a Secretary of State who has been feeding a frenzy about the falsely about the existence of voting fraud in New Hampshire. It seems rather cavalier, the kind of guidance that he's giving now, both verbally and in writing. So I think we should insist that this expansion of access be codified. We don't want people risking fines, being encouraged in this moment to interpret things loosely. We need for their benefit to put this into law.
And it would also be good for the process to be modernized so that people can do more of this online. Obviously, I like the idea of more use of the Postal Service. It's a good idea. And we'll talk more later on in this show with Janice Kelby from the American Postal Workers Union about challenges that the whole Postal Service is undergoing right now. But that's nothing new. But we really can be making use of online registration and perhaps getting to a point where secure voting can be taking place that way. I know other states are experimenting in this and are way ahead of New Hampshire. And I think it really is because, for a variety of reasons, Bill Gardner has been reluctant to go for a use of a more technologically based system.
That's right. Now, so yes, let's hope for some continued progress.
Right. As Maggie noted, we have shifted from live broadcasts of our weekly State House Watch show to pre-recording. While we are pre-recording on Monday morning, the governor's lawyers and the legislators' lawyers are actually in court at Hillsborough County North in Manchester debating whether the governor does in fact have unilateral emergency authority to accept and spend federal money, or whether the legislature has that authority by law through the operation of the Joint Fiscal Committee. So I'm sorry that we're not able to comment further on that right now, but stay tuned and we will certainly provide an update in State House Watch news coming up this Friday, and we'll talk about it again on this show next week. But Maggie, right as we were sending out the newsletter on Friday, some interesting news broke with the American Civil Liberties Union and some of their private law firm partners filed a lawsuit in federal court calling for the release of immigrants who are being held in detention at the jail in Dover. Can you say a little bit more about that lawsuit?
Yes, thank you. So the ACLU, with several partner law firms, have brought a class action lawsuit. So this is on behalf of everyone in ICE custody at the Stafford County Jail, and it is targeted toward Immigration and Customs Enforcement, demanding the immediate release of everyone who is in civil detention with ICE, predicated on the fact that it is impossible to maintain social distancing guidelines of 6 feet when someone is in a jail or prison. It's impossible at the Dover facility. So we're excited to see this development. I'm unclear how quickly the matter will be considered and decided upon. This builds on a recent very positive decision in Massachusetts when Judge Young decided on behalf of a class of ICE detainees there that they could not be safely held and simply did not need to be in detention at this time.
But we'll be continuing to pay attention to that. This week on State House Watch, we're paying attention to workers on the front line. So stay tuned for an interview with Janice Kelby, an interview with Jenny Marshall, and an interview with Adam Kaczynski talking about their workplace experiences and how they are affected. But before we go to that, we are thinking about John Prine, who passed away recently. Here's John Prine.
When I get to heaven, I'm going to shake God's hand, thank him for more blessings than one man can stand. Then I'm going to get a guitar and start a rock and roll band. Check into a swell hotel. Ain't the afterlife grand? And then I'm going to get a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm going to smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm going to kiss that pretty girl on the tilt-a-whirl. Cause this old man is going to town. Then as God is my witness, I'm getting back into show business. I'm going to open up a nightclub called the Tree of Forgiveness and forgive everybody ever done me any harm. Why, I might even invite a few choice critics, those syphilitic parasitics. Buy them a pint of Smithix and smother them with my charm. Cause then I'm going to get a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm going to smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm gonna kiss that pretty girl on the tilt-a-whirl. Yeah, this old man is going to town. Get to heaven, I'm gonna take that wristwatch off my arm. What are you gonna do with time after you bought the farm? And then I'm gonna go find my mom and dad and good old brother Doug. Why, I bet him and cousin Jackie are still cutting up a rug. I want to see all my mama's sisters, because that's where all the love starts. I miss them all like crazy. Bless her little hearts. And I always will remember these words my daddy said. He said, "Buddy, when you're dead, you're a dead peckerhead." I hope to prove him wrong. That is, when I get to heaven. 'Cause I'm gonna have a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm gonna smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm gonna kiss that pretty girl on the tilt-a-whirl. Yeah, this old man is going to town. Yeah, this old man is going to town.
This is State House Watch Radio. I'm in our Zoom studio with Janice Kelby of the American Postal Workers Union. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Maggie.
Thanks for being here. Why don't you tell us what you're a little bit about yourself? This is your first time on State House Watch Radio, so we'd love to hear a little more about you.
It is, and thanks for inviting me. My name is Janice Kelby, and I was a postal worker, worked night shift for 29 years, and then retired, but I continue to work as the legislative director for Manchester Area Local APWU, which is the American Postal Workers Union, and for the New Hampshire State Postal Workers.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So these must be interesting times for the Postal Service in a lot of ways, but let's start with the fact that postal workers are essential workers. They have always been essential. They are certainly deemed essential in this public health crisis. What are you seeing in terms of the health and well-being of postal workers in New Hampshire, in New England?
Well, we've been, relatively speaking, lucky in New Hampshire as far as not being one of the first places that was really hit hard with COVID-19. But some of our brothers and sisters in places like New York have experienced a far different thing for postal workers there. But like you said, it is an essential business. We deliver mail to people that really depend on it, including medication, contact lenses, medical testing that gets sent off to labs, all kinds of things. I mean,
bills, checks.
We do that, and we do that to every household in the United States. We actually deliver probably, I think it's 47% of the mail in the entire world.
Wow.
To put it in a little bit of perspective, while there's certainly other delivery places out there, I read the other day that the U.S. Postal Service delivers in one day as much as FedEx delivers in an entire year. And I think it was a week, the comparison with UPS. So we are by and far the largest delivery service that there is. On Earth, actually.
My goodness. And how are local carriers, not just carriers, though, counter workers and mailroom workers being affected by COVID-19 in this area?
I mean, like anybody else who has a job to do that's essential and then still goes home, our brothers and sisters are very worried about what they might be picking up. And then, I mean, they're face to face with customers all the time. They're also handling mail, and we don't even really know. It's been assumed, and the CDC has said several times that they don't think you could get it from that kind of contact, but then they go, well, yes, it can live for so long on cardboard and for so long on paper, and how many people are handling that mail? I mean, it really is a concern. And then on top of that concern, there's a lot of people who go and meet their letter carrier to pick up their mail, and for clerks, and those are the people that we represent clerks, we represent drivers, and we represent maintenance and custodial people. There's separate unions, but we're all postal workers, and we're all essential, and we're all in it together, basically. Window clerks, they started, when this first started, nobody had any protective equipment, but they've been pretty responsive here, I have to say. I was talking to my local president today, and he was saying he was actually surprised that, to his amazement, that they've pretty much stepped up to the plate and trying to get equipment and developing a system where they have basically a Google Doc where they keep track of where the equipment is, so that if somebody is lacking something, they can go in and see where that stuff is and get it as fast as possible. But they also started putting up things like you may have seen in some grocery stores where they put up the plastic shields between the customer and the window clerk. Mm-hmm. And they have marked out in those stations, they mark out places on the floor for where they want customers to stand. But still, I know in New York City, when it hit, as you know, that hit everybody so hard there. There, the local president was actually calling for them to shut down because it got so bad. And they had like 4 or 5 deaths. He was pretty concerned, and people were, they had no protection at that time. They didn't have gloves for them. They didn't have masks for them, nothing. And worse than that was the lack of communication. They weren't telling people what was happening. If there was a positive COVID case in their office, the people weren't even being told. So,
wow.
And the lack of testing has, you know, lack of communication and lack of testing has been the biggest problem. But
right. That's contrary to good public health practice, for sure. Yeah. What are the numbers in New Hampshire or perhaps in New England with regard to infections, and have there been any deaths among U.S. Postal Service workers here?
Yeah, there have been a couple of deaths. Mostly, I think they were in the New York area. But on 4/10... there were 599 cases in the New England area, positive COVID cases.
April 10th, you're saying?
Yeah, and in 1 week, it jumped almost 200 and was up to 772 cases. So, I mean, it's definitely a big concern. And when I was talking to my local president today, he said that there's certainly people who are not coming to work right now because they live, because they're being exposed to the public any way you look at it. And,
sure.
And they either are high risk themselves or they're living with people who are super high risk. So they've chosen to use their leave and stay at home. But as soon as we get, I guess we just got the first case in Northern New England of a positive COVID identification. It was just announced to them today. And that was—
You mean a death?
No, not a death. It was first case that was this far north. Most
Cleveland
cases were Massachusetts, New York, and Connecticut before. Now it's up in Northern New England. This case was in Maine. And he was saying that he does have some concerns that, you know, if we have it in Manchester or Nashua, where we have pretty big plants where people are all together, that he expects that they'll lose some
workers, saying it's just simply not safe. I'm not willing to take that risk. Yes. Wow. Well, and so this is an enormous burden for an institution that was already under siege, wasn't it, in terms of its financial security, well, its financial insecurity. Talk a little bit about the broader advocacy that needs to happen to make sure that we continue to have a postal service. And maybe first, make the case for why we need a strong, viable postal service in the United States?
I mean, we've really, the postal service funded itself through sales of stamps and services since the 1980s up until probably till about 2008. But in 2006, when they were making fully self-supporting, doing better than they ever had before, Congress passed a law, it's called the Postal Accountability Act, that required the Postal Service to pre-fund future retiree health care benefits 75 years out. So they literally had to pre-fund retiree health care benefits for people who hadn't even been born yet. Nobody else has to do that. It's a ridiculous requirement. It's not a common practice. And in my opinion, it was basically using the Postal Service as a cash cow. But then 2 years later, along came the recession and the Postal Service got hit hard. So they could no longer afford to pay future retiree health care benefits for 75 years out. And they started falling behind. And, you know, and then the Postal Service kind of exacerbated some of the problems in like 2013 when they started closing some plants and facilities and cutting back services to try to live within that budget. And that's kind of a self-perpetuating destruction. I mean, I think for a long time, there have been people, corporations, individuals, I'm sure, eyeing the profitable parts of the Postal Service. Because if you took the cream of the crop, you could probably make some pretty decent money on it. But then you wouldn't be delivering to Berlin, New Hampshire. You wouldn't be, what's that mail boat that's up at Winnipesaukee that takes mail to the people on the islands there? Mm-hmm. You'd be delivering in inner city high crime areas because those are not profitable. And you wouldn't be paying the same price. Berlin, New Hampshire would not be getting a 50-cent stamp, I guarantee you. So there's parts of the Postal Service that people would like to pick off. But think about things like when you move. Right now, you put in a change of address thing to your local post office. If it was private, you might not even know who would be delivering your mail next week, let alone where to turn in your address change. I mean, it's a real nice fantasy to talk about privatizing the Postal Service, but the bottom line is, it should be a public service. It benefits everybody in this country. It's actually in the Constitution that we have a public post office.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I mean, yeah. I certainly shared the belief that it was a fundamental element of a strong community, a strong society, to have public delivery of mail.
But we have some problems in the current business model, okay? One of the, obviously, the pre-funding is a biggie. But there are also constraining prices when price raises are necessary. I mean, right now, the U.S. Postal Service has the least expensive mail delivery of any major industrial country. I mean, it's people who complain about the price of stamps, they almost laugh. I mean, when you think about it, how cheap that is and what people pay for a cup of coffee when they're out during the day. I understand it's a struggle for some people and for businesses and things, but it's just such a necessary. It's also the biggest employer of veterans. I mean, there's 640,000 postal employees across this country.
Wow.
It's also a big employer of minorities. I mean, it's decent jobs for a lot of people. It's not outrageously paying jobs, but it's decent jobs that allow people to be a part of the middle class, mm-hmm. and enables people to get medication they need, mail that they need, business mail that they need, medical.
Well, what does the Postal Service need now from Congress? And then talk about what we can do as people who agree with you. What kind of steps can people take?
To start with, when this first stimulus package was being formed, when our legislators met and discussed what things should be in it, they asked for $25 billion for the Postal Service as an infusion to make sure, I mean, the volume, I don't think I mentioned how badly the volume has been impacted since this whole COVID crisis started. But I can just say personally that, and I'm a postal worker, I mean, my heart's there, But I avoided going to the post office, okay? Because I didn't want to be breathing on my brothers and sisters standing there that had no protection. I mean, I did not go and mail my grandson a birthday present because I said I can give it to him later, but it doesn't make sense. That's not really essential, so I won't go out and do that, okay? But there's been a huge drop in mail service now, and it's probably the worst time because at the same time that CDC is talking about developing a self-COVID test where people can do a swab themselves and mail it in to get tested, who's going to deliver it if we're not there, okay? We need to be there, and we need to be able to offer reliable service. So they went in asking for $25 billion. Although I understand the airline industry got $61 billion, and the cruise lines, I don't have my little list here with me of how much each little
section. How many tens of billions they were
getting.
This is, by the way, just to clarify, this is in the federal COVID relief packages. Yeah.
Yes. And there were billions and billions and billions of dollars that were given out to assist people with COVID relief. What they did instead of giving any kind of stimulus relief directly, what they did is enable them to raise their borrowing power by $10 billion. That is not going to cut it. And it is estimated by numerous sources at this point that the Postal Service could collapse before the end of the year if we can't get more help than that.
I mean, oh my gosh.
Revenue is going down significantly enough that that is a big issue now.
Oh my gosh.
Legislators are meeting now, and I think it's like I'm not sure exactly what it is they're asking for in the second stimulus bill. And we have a website that's pretty easy to remember.
Good. Give that out. And as I understand it, people can go there to send a message to our members of Congress, right? About this particular aspect.
Yeah, there will be a pre-written message that you can send to your legislators, and it will ask you to pick a topic. And sometimes people get confused on that. And sometimes I sit there and go, well, like Jean Shaheen has postal as one of her topics, but Maggie Hassan doesn't. So you look through, I mean, pick anything, pick health, pick the economy, because it impacts so many things that any one of these, they'll send it to the place that is most appropriate. But start out by going to usmailnotforsale.com. So that's all one, not a word, but it's all squished together as a word, usmailnotforsale.com.
And the four is written out as F-O-R.
Yes.
Okay, usmailnotforsale.com. We encourage people to go there to join your voice to this advocacy for really important investments in our essential U.S. Postal Service, suffering now during COVID-19, but also, you know, having struggled for a long time in need of federal backing, you know, to ensure its longevity.
I mean, there are a lot of states that, and New Hampshire is not yet one of them, hopefully it will become one, but that already have vote by mail. There's three states that have total vote by mail. That's the method they use for voting, period. But there are many, many other states, in fact, all but 9 states in the country offer some kind of either no excuse absentee or some type of early voting opportunity. We all saw what just happened in Wisconsin, and I don't think that was a pretty sight at all to see people standing in lines next to other people when they were supposed to be. They were ordered to stay at home, and instead they had to choose between going out, even if they were high risk people, they had to choose between going out and risking their health or life or voting. That shouldn't be a choice that anybody needs to make. So that's definitely, I mean, I think that this whole COVID thing has opened our eyes up to a whole lot of things. And if we ever needed the Postal Service before, we need it 10 times more now.
Amen. That's a perfect note to wrap up on. If we ever needed it before, it's absolutely clear to us how much we need it now. Janice Kelby, thank you so much for your time right now, but also your advocacy on behalf of the Postal Service and really on behalf of all of us. I appreciate this chance to be with you.
Thank you.
Take good care.
Okay, don't forget, U.S. Mail, not for sale.
The U.S. Mail is not for sale. You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP. Here's a song about spring flowers and the hope that all will be well again. This is Anne Mayo Muir, Ed Trickett, and Gordon Bach.
You are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty, and I'm in our Zoom studio now with Jenny Marshall from the Salem School District. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Maggie. Hi, everybody. So,
tell us a little bit about who you are and the work that you do, and then we'll jump in.
I am a resident of Dover, but an employee of the Salem School District. I've been there for something like 13 years. I've been an educator for over 20 and have worked in a variety of settings, but public education is the one where I've spent the most time. My role is director of literacy, which is a curriculum position. a district-wide position. And as part of that role, I managed the Title I grant. I managed the Title III grant, which is targeted at second language speakers to support those students. And I'm the homeless liaison in my district.
All right. So you're in a position not only as an educator, but as somebody who's working closely with students who are perhaps from immigrant families, from low-income families, from economically insecure households, to really have a perspective on how this COVID-19 crisis is impacting vulnerable people in the state. So can you talk from those multiple perspectives about what you've seen in the last, I don't know if we say 5 weeks now, 4 weeks now, about how this is unfolding in your district?
You know, I think we had some anticipation early on that something might happen. Weeks before, we had the stay-at-home orders and the school closing orders from the governor the first time. And so we had been able to begin planning with sort of difficulty wrapping our heads around, like, what do you think might happen? Nobody really kind of could envision this because we've never really dealt with anything like this before. But we were lucky enough to have a group of people that got together, and we sort of identified, like, what are the minimum expectations that we would hope we could make happen for students if we did go to a full remote scenario. We also looked at a scenario of possibly seeing some students out or some staff members out and some in, so sort of a dual remote and on-site scenario. And we kind of created, honestly, sort of an emergency plan that we could put into place if we needed to. I think it was March 15th. A few days before that, I had actually been away, and I got a message that all of the administrators were coming into the building on Sunday. So I zoomed in from Colorado, where I was with my daughter, and our superintendent kind of gave us an outline of what was about to happen on the next day. And that meant that we were ready to roll into and implement the framework of the plan that we had put together, but it obviously needed more work. And so the administrators, that group of district leaders, worked from about 11 in the morning till about 5:30 or 6 that night, really laying out more specifically what we were going to do. We brought teachers in on Monday for some training. We knew exactly what that was going to be, and we were ready for it. And we were able to give them Tuesday to plan. Students came in and picked up equipment, and we are very lucky to have been able to provide laptops or Chromebooks to any student that needed them, including families where there were multiple children and they might have needed an additional device. And then those were already sort of laid out. Our IT department had pushed out the tools that we needed so that every child already had those on their Chromebooks, especially the elementary kids. And where we had families, it took us a while to kind of get this sorted out, but where we had families that did not have internet access, we were able to provide a Kijit, a hotspot, and those were also either picked up or in some cases, in a number of cases, guidance counselors or district people went out and delivered materials that needed to be delivered. So that was sort of that first week, was just scrambling and getting everything going. And the lessons and the teaching actually began on that Thursday.
All right. So it's been about 4 weeks now of remote learning. I assume for some grade levels, it's synchronous for parts of the day. Maybe for other grade levels, it might be more of a check-in type thing. What does that look like, the remote learning?
Interestingly enough, a lot of the synchronous activities are happening at the primary and elementary grade levels. The teachers and the children, I think those relationships are so intense. Those bonds are very strong. And it's been just lovely to see the way the elementary teachers, they've gone way above and beyond the minimum requirements. We didn't put anything in like you have to have a morning meeting, or we just looked at, you know, sort of what will reading, math, and other activities look like, and how are we going to identify what's enough or what we want to do. But they really attended to the issues of community, of social and emotional needs of students. And honestly, that's true, you know, through the district. I do see a much greater involvement with the elementary teachers. And, you know, I'm kind of going on a little bit, but what's really come of that, and I think I saw this on the news this morning from the Concord superintendent, is the teachers have really felt like they are establishing a much deeper kind of relationship with the whole child, the child and the family, and parents. They're supporting parents. Parents are supporting them. And it's really been an amazing team kind of endeavor, I guess. And honestly, it's choked me up. I don't even know how many times, you know, I've gotten a lump in my throat and tears in my eyes, really being touched by the dedication of teachers, the kind of love, community love that sometimes we worry isn't there. It's grown, it's blossomed. It's kind of a beautiful thing, actually. So yeah, that is not to say that parents aren't feeling overwhelmed and sharing some of those feelings. That is not to say that teachers who have young children that they're also trying to help get through schooling are not almost at their wit's end. Those things are true too at the same time. I think everybody's keenly aware of that. And that's the sort of reciprocal awareness of parents are aware of what teachers are going through. Teachers are aware of what parents are going through. And there is, I mean, I think almost without exception, an enormous generosity of giving each other space to get done what needs to get done.
Wow, that's really lovely.
Yeah, it is.
Well, then, so thank you for that. That really is moving to hear. And it conforms with my experience of the teachers in my life and the parents describing how their children are being supported and stretching and everybody stretching and trying to be creative. So the recent news, we learned yesterday that Governor Sununu has called for schools to remain remote for the remainder of the school year. Was that a surprise to you? Does that shift how you're managing things?
No, but interestingly enough, I've had a number of meetings today with my teams. I mostly honestly work with teachers who work with kids. In all of these different populations. And, you know, that was a part of the conversation. I think, first of all, you know, we've had these conversations. We have these regular administrative meetings just to make sure we're all running in the same direction. We're not bumping into each other. Our superintendent has been incredible with, you know, letting us know what might happen without giving us too much uncertainty. I think there's a lot of, and I think those are the same challenges we're all facing, any leaders, teachers, is to say, we might not come back. We don't know yet. But my concern has been, and I voice this, is that, you know, as a rower and an athlete, I would participate in a lot of races, and they were fairly intense. And the one thing that made the challenge doable was knowing when the finish line was and being able to sort of mete out your energy so that you would make it all the way to and maybe through the finish line. And those have been conversations that our district leaders have been having all along, discussing the need to ensure that this is a sustainable activity, that it's sustainable not just until the intermediate finish line, but the potential finish line. It's much easier when someone says you have 500 meters to go and you find out it's only 300 meters. It's much more difficult to have someone say, okay, there's another 20 and another 20 and another 20. So I think we've been very mindful of that in terms of messaging. And I, again, my superintendent has been very careful to give us enough information to help us prepare for what might happen without throwing 3,000 scenarios into our laps at the same time. So I think people were ready. But what I will say, and this was part of our conversation today, is that little glimmer of hope that we might come back that we might be able to reconvene in person, that we might actually be able to hug each other before this is over. That was oddly, and I think subconsciously, sustaining us in some ways that we weren't aware of. And
I'm seeing those sentiments. And as I mentioned, we have some teachers in our neighborhood. I'm hearing that sense of, like, logically, this, of course, was very predictable, but something in me is suffering in a new way for not having that hope anymore for this
term. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think about, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about the seniors in high school and what this means, the eighth graders who are used to particular. I think what's happened is, you know, our whole worlds have been turned upside down, and there are some very specific rituals and rites of passage that are part of a public school or any school experience, really, that sort of are comforting. They bring joy. They're anticipated. They're part of what it means to be a part of a community. It's about being recognized, and, you know, very much for kids who are developing and, you know, sort of establishing their identities, how they are recognized within the school system is part of that process. And it's all thrown on its head. And I think we all, and including kids, you know, held out hope that we would be able to have some of these rituals that are often end of year field day for the elementary students.
The spring sports,
kindergarten orientation for the incoming kindergarten students and their parents, eighth grade move up day, fifth grade move up day and orientation, you know,
yeah,
all
classic.
Of that.
Yeah.
So I think those were the little things in particular that we were sort of thinking, like, well, maybe we'll be able to figure out a way to do this. And I think it's become very clear that we can't. And, yeah. and that sort of finality is now we're in the full, like, I have to accept this in some way, and I have to figure out, you know, there are many things to be grateful for that have come out of this, including some really innovative and amazing teaching practices and, you know, students who were not necessarily engaged in person have come out in different ways online. So, but I think the loss of those rituals and those sort of rites of passage are, you know, that's something to grieve. And I think there is a sort of community grieving going on today, right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for naming that. I think that's very important to acknowledge. We only just have about 30 seconds left, and I want to just get clarification. So each school district will decide how to handle grades. Each school district will decide their final class day for this school year. And then there'll be some consideration statewide and district-wide for how to start the new school year with the additional resources that will surely be needed to help connect kids and level them up, or whatever.
Absolutely.
The phrase is.
I am in an odd position because along with a couple of my colleagues, have put in for retirement this year. And you will hear it here in my voice right now. This is a rough way to go. It really is. And I didn't mean to get tearful, but
it's okay.
I want to be here to help, and I probably will be here to help in some way, but this is how my career ends. And, you know, there is a certain grief in that too.
There is. Well, Jenny Marshall, thank you so much for the beautiful work that you do, for spending time with us, and for all of the important messages that you've lifted up. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you and this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Maggie.
This is Statehouse Watch. Is the pandemic making you lonely? You're not alone. Here's a classic from Bobby Vinton.
Lonely, I'm Mr. Lonely. I have nobody for my own. I'm so lonely. I'm Mr. Lonely. Wish I had someone. to call on the phone. Now I'm a soldier, a lonely soldier, away from home, through no wish of my own. That's why I'm lonely, I'm Mr. Lonely. I wish that I could go back home. Letters, never a letter. I get no letters in the mail. I've been forgotten. Forgotten. Oh, how I wonder, how is it I fail? Now I'm a soldier, a lonely soldier, away from home, through no wish of my own. That's why I'm lonely, I'm Mr. Lonely. I wish that I could go back home.
This is State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert, and I'm on the line with Adam Kaczynski, the president of Local 201 of RUECWA in Lynn, Massachusetts. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. If you could just start out by saying a little bit about who your union represents and how you have been organizing to have safe working conditions.
Yeah, we represent 1,250 people at General Electric in Lynn, people at Amatec Aerospace in Wilmington, Saugus Public Library, Avis Budget in Boston, and Veolia Wastewater Treatment Plant in Lynn. We've started a campaign in early March at General Electric because we felt as essential workers that had to work through the shutdown, the company needed to provide us with a safer working environment, better supplies, PPE, and increased time off. So we've been working on that campaign for over a month, and we've made some improvements around PPE and working conditions, but not nearly enough to feel safe working there. So we're still pushing through petitions and through protests to get the company to offer a wide range of PPE and sanitary working conditions.
Your union certainly has a long history and strong reputation for activist orientation toward your workplace, but also toward the community. How are you finding it possible to organize differently in this environment?
So we've been going online for most of the solidarity stuff. We have a petition at moveon.org that concentrates on Trump signing the DPA, the Defense Production Act, and forcing GE to up its ventilator production. And then we also have a petition with Massachusetts Jobs of Justice to support what we're calling our 5S campaign, which is supplies, sanitation, 6 feet, sick time, and serve the public.
And you're getting some response so far from GE on that?
Yeah, we've gotten much more PPE in. And the cleaning schedule has amped up. It's not to where we feel that it's safe. We want it between the shifts, what's called electrostatic spray, where they positively charge the disinfectant particles and it more evenly coats surfaces to disinfect. We'd like to see that between every shift. Right now, they're doing it after a positive test result or a confirmed exposure. But we feel that everybody has a right to come into a shift in a safe environment that's been sterilized.
Well, I think all workers have the right to safe working conditions, so it's good that you're organized and having some effective ways to demand it. Now, Adam Kaczynski, you mentioned that you're actually trying to get GE to produce ventilators. It's kind of an unusual thing. Usually, oftentimes we think about workers stopping work. So in a sense, for workers to be demanding work on a different product is, from my perspective, at least unusual and creative. Could you say a little bit more about GE ventilators, the Defense Production act and how your union is working on this nationally.
Yeah. So GE is one of the major producers of ventilators in this country. And because of the increased demand, they went to Ford and offered them their management, their engineers, their supply chain, their vendors, their planning, their schematics, their blueprints, and said, why don't we do these at Ford? Meanwhile, GE's announced layoffs across the country and some plant closures in union shops. So what we've been saying to GE is put this work in these plants, put it in Bucyrus, Ohio, put it in Salem, Virginia, put it in Dallas, Texas, where we're skilled manufacturing workers and we can crank these things out with the kind of support that GE is providing for it.
And so far, how many places have you been making these demands? And how have you actually been exercising these demands on the company? Are you out picketing? Are you having demonstrations in the parking lot? How is the word getting out?
There's about five locations, GE locations, that have been part of these protests. We've done several pickets, both in front of headquarters and in front of the plants that the IUE represents in the GE supply chain. And also we're doing letter writing, petitions, and then picketing and protest.
Can you tell yet if you're having any impact on GE management with regard to this decision and this proposal?
I think it's too early to tell. What it's really going to take, in my analysis, is Trump signing the Defense Production Act. Once the power to decide, you know, what is produced is swayed in the direction of the general good, I don't think that they'll have much of a choice. So I'm hoping that President Trump signs that DPA. I think that's what it's going to take for GE to give to this demand.
Well, good. Well, I don't want us to all vest our hopes in President Trump, but certainly with some public pressure and people joining you by signing these petitions will certainly help. So Adam Kaczynski, I want to thank you for your time today and wish the best of luck to you and to members of Local 201. Carry on.
Thank you.
We'll post the links to those petitions with the podcast from this show.
You've been listening to Statehouse Watch, a production of the American Friends Service Committee's New Hampshire program on WNHN-LP. Stay tuned at 94.7 FM or WNHNFM.org for more progressive talk plus jazz, blues, classical, and oldies. Community radio helps our community stay close even when we're physically apart. Join us again next week for another episode of Statehouse Watch. We're going down the road.
Going down the road, baby. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Don't want to be treated this way. Going down the road, feeling bad.